still warm from the presence of the people from
Well, thank you very much, and thank you to Sir John and Sir Ian. All I've got to do now is to dot the I's and cross the T's. Let me read you the opening sentences of the book. Renowned curator Jacques Saunier staggered through the vaulted archway of the museum's grand gallery. He lunged for the nearest painting he could see, a Caravaggio. Grabbing the gilded frame, the 76-year-old man heaved the masterpiece towards himself, and it tore from the wall, and Saunier collapsed backwards in a heap beneath the canvas. Well, those are the opening sentences from Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. Complete nonsense, of course, the book, but it's a splendid read. It's one of those page turners. And openings of books are important, aren't they? They grab our attention and author put a lot of effort into that first paragraph. But endings are important too. And I don't know about you, but when you're reading a thriller like The Da Vinci Code, and it's midnight, and you're only two-thirds of the way through, it's really tempting to turn to the last few pages to see what happens. In fact, if you turn to the end of the Da Vinci Code, you find that it ends very close to here, not to give any secrets away. Now, we already know how God's story ends. We know who wins. So it begins with a creation, and it ends with a new creation, a new heaven, a new earth. It begins with God walking with Adam in the garden, and it ends with God coming down to live with his people. It ends in a world where there'll be no more tears, no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain. And isn't that something we look forward to in a world that's wrapped by pain? It seems to me that if we're to make sense of this world in which we live, if we're to live a life in it, we need to know where it came from and where it's heading. And that's why the Bible tells us so clearly. But in between, of course, it's a fallen world. It's a world that's been redeemed by Christ's death on the cross, but it's awaiting the full consummation of the new creation when Christ returns. So here's my outline on the screen. It's a good three-point heading. And if you're minded into one, you can look for the alliterations in the heading. But before I launch into this, I want to say one thing very clearly. A couple of weeks ago, I gave a talk in a central Cambridge church, and this was the question they gave me: should Christians be green? And I want to say, no, they should not. Not if that greenness makes it a single issue. Not if that greenness is a sort of new age hug a tree, preserving such a word in some previous golden age. I think it's important that Christianity is not hung up on a single issue, such as being green. And I think that is part of the problem our friends from North America have with part of the evangelical grouping there, that they see greenness as a distraction. The most important thing, I want to say this very clearly, right at the beginning of my talk, in case you go away with the wrong idea, the most important thing of all is getting back into a right relationship with God, of turning around our self-centered ways, of putting ourselves first and putting God first as sovereign again. But having said that, it is important to remember that the way we treat the world, this environment which God created, is part of how we honour and worship him. And the way we consider the consequences of what we do and their impact on others is again a reflection of our Christian love for our neighbours, as we've been hearing already this morning. And God's very first commandment in the Bible is to care for the world on his behalf. So if we don't do that, we're being disobedient. So what I said to this church group in Cambridge is, no, Christians should not be green, they should be multicoloured. And as you know, white light is composed of a spectrum of colours, which you see in a rainbow. And from this picture you will deduce that we've had a very wet summer and a very wet holiday. But just reflecting on this, is it striking that green is the very core of the rainbow of colours, isn't it? You've got red, orange and yellow on one side, green right down the middle, the background of it, and then blue, indigo and violet on the other. So let's keep that in the back of our minds as we turn back to the beginning of the story, which is God's creation, shown right in the very first book of the Bible, Genesis 1. And that foundation is important because it sets the whole tone of what comes afterwards. I know terms in Britain are very fond of having a mission statement nowadays. So this Genesis 1 is God's mission statement. And I want to highlight three things it says about God's purposes and about our place in cosmos from this chapter. And the first thing is a very simple one. You might think it's so simple that why am I bothering to say it? Is that God created the universe. Verse 1, chapter 1, Genesis, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And it says the same thing right at the beginning of the New Testament in John's Gospel, chapter 1, verse 3. Through him, and as we heard this morning, that's referring to Jesus, all things were made. And just in case you don't get the point, it says the same thing the other way around again. In fact, nothing that has been made was made without him. So that's pretty clear. Well, you might think it's obvious to make this point that God created the world, but it is in direct opposition to what many people thought at the time Genesis was written. They thought the world was a fallout, a battle between gods, that humans were just created to be slaves of the gods, and so on and so forth. Or maybe even people thought that the earth was just a happenstance, an accidental occurrence, and we just happen to be here. Which is not so far from what many people believe today who are not believers. Well, Genesis gives the lie to that right in chapter 1 of the Bible. It proclaims that creation is purposeful, created by the will of God, he spoke it happened, and that it is ordered, that God brought order out of chaos. It proclaims that God exists independently of the universe. If the universe ceased to exist, God would still exist. So God is separate from his universe, even though he's deeply engaged with it. Well, the second point is also a very obvious one, but it's worth saying, that God's creation is good. And that comes through again and again in the first chapter of Genesis. God made the first day, and what does it say in verse 4? God saw that the light was good. Second day, God saw that it was good. Third day, God made the vegetation, the plants and trees, God saw that it was good. Fourth day, he made the sun and moon and stars, God saw that it gets a bit boring, doesn't it? Fifth day, God saw that it was good. Sixth day, God. You really get the impression of the writer of Genesis was trying to make a point. The sixth day, God saw everything that had been made, including humans, and it was very good. Well, we can't fail to get the message, can we? God's material creation is good. Matter matters to God. And Christianity is a very materialist religion in this sense. It's rooted in the material world. God came to Rome in a specific place, in the Middle East when it was under Roman rule, at a specific time. And that is completely different to almost every other religion in the world. And it also gives the lie to the fact that we should strive for some higher spiritual plane. The material things of this world are somehow bad to be striven against. So Christianity has its feet firmly on the ground. And I rather like that because, as you heard, I'm a geologist. So God says, unambiguously, that he made the world, and that it's a good world. And God gloried in his creation, and his creation in turn reflects something of his glory, something of his character. The heavens declare the glory of God, says Psalm 19. Now, I've purposely chosen this image as my background. It's an image taken from Apollo 8 in 1968, the first time that humans went around the moon. And apparently it is the most reproduced image in the world ever. An iconic image. And it's got that picture of the very fragile Earth floating in the darkness of space, with all of life, as we know, in that very tiny little rim around the edge. Now, another amazing thing happened on Apollo 8. The three astronauts, Lovell, Anders and Borman, spent most of their time talking about technical data back and forth to Earth. But on Christmas Eve, 1968, they made this broadcast. Now, the sound isn't all that good, so you'll have to listen hard, because they were a quarter of a million miles away from Earth, and it was 1968.
This is the Washington Space creation story.
Preventing the created order from reflecting God's glory fully. It's
kind of like the picture that if we don't care for the world in which we live, we're acting rather like the teenagers who, with a wild party, when their parents are away for the weekend, destroy the family home that the parents have lovingly created. And that actually happened in Britain around Easter, was in the headlines of all the newspapers. Chris Patten put it this way. Chris Patten was the last governor of Hong Kong before it was handed over to the Chinese. He said, "We should care for the environment by living here as though we were intending to stay for good, not just for the weekend." That's a good way of looking at it. Now, I just want to say that there is a tension, there's many tensions in Scripture, and there is a tension between humans who are made at the pinnacle of God's creation, since the star made, he made us just a little lower than the angels. Think of the 13.7 billion years of evolution, of creation, making all those stars, terraforming the earth, making oxygen and so on, so humans, it'd be just right for humans to live in. Humans, in one sense, are at the pinnacle of God's creation, and he made humans have a relationship with him. But I also want to keep in tension with that, the fact that God loves the world and his creation independently of humans. We had two readings from Job. Had a reading from Job right at the beginning, and he mentioned there the lions roaring for their prey. This shows the scripture is of a unity. Here's the famous quote from Psalm 104, the lions roar for their prey and seek their food from God. Or again, Psalm 147, it talks about God supplying the earth with rain and making grass grow on the hill. But also, God provides food for the cattle and for the young ravens when they fall. God loves his creation and cares for it. Psalm 55, I could pick many more. It talks about how God is intimately involved in caring for his creation. He makes the rain to come. And creation in its turn declares his glory. There's lots of imagery about the mountains singing for joy, rivers clapping their hands. And in Psalm 65, 9 there, the valleys are mantled with rain, they shout for joy and sing. So that's the abundant response of creation towards a fruitful creator. But you might say the world is not a good world, is it? Not completely. The 20th century was the most murderous century in the history of humankind. Hundreds of millions of people were killed by their fellow humans. So the world now, which is out of kilter, there's still beauty and love and fruitfulness in this world, but it's as if they are marred. It's as if they're just an echo of how God made the world in the first place. Or as if, as Paul puts it in Romans 8, and to all creation is groaning, as in the pains of childbirth. Now it's interesting that groaning is the pains of childbirth. And if you've ever been with your wife, if you're a man, you know that is very painful. But the childbirth is a longing for something which will be better. And the instant that child is born, all that pain is forgotten. Things will be put back right again. So that's why we read about God's command for us to care for this world. And that's the second reason we should care for it, because God actually tells us to quite unambiguously. Now I just want to say the reason why, or the way he wants us to care for it, is he wants us to care for it because we are made in his image. We're made in the image of God. Now, we could have another long theological treatise on what being made in the image of God means. There's no doubt, though, that humans are different from animals. We might share 98.5 of our DNA with chimpanzees, but there's something different. We are animals, plus we are something different. That includes a number of things, like most certainly being able to relate to God in a personal way, which is apparently what God wants more than anything. He made us to have relationship with him, to respond to him. To love and be loved, and if you want to see the hallmark of what love is, we look to God. Be created in the way God was created. He flung stars into space, just because he created it. And I think one of the significant things about humans is that they are moral beings. They really care about justice. People really, really care about justice. And that's why the gospel is good news, because justice will be done completely in the cosmos at the end of time. So Genesis highlights the commonalities between humanity and the rest of animated creation, but also draws out the profession of the humans made in the image of God. So we share the same food as other animals, it says in Genesis 1:29. We breathe the same breath of life in animals and humans. We're formed from the ground. In fact, we're formed from the dust of the ground, humans were, which is hardly an accolade of superiority. But right there, in Genesis 1, 28, there's God's first command to us that we should rule over and take care of both the living and the non-living creation. We're not to be passive spectators, but we're to work at ruling. It's hard work, without destroying the earth for our own selfish ends. And it's part of our obedience and worship of God to do that. Well, we heard the point that one way of describing that is to be good stewards. Although I think in modern parlance, stewardship is rather a weak term. It's stronger than that. We can rule over it in order where there is disorder. Perhaps rather like our garden, I regret to say, where unless you keep the weeds under control, they take over. If you want the vegetable patch to be fruitful, you've got to work at it to make it fruitful. So this commandment is a command to use the earth's resources and our abilities to understand something of the way they work for the good of others, and that includes, of course, technology. And of course, human well-being and human flourishing are intrinsically linked to the rest of creation in the biblical narrative. So we should care for the earth in the same way as God himself cares for it. That's what the Bible says. With the, if you like, five regions on God's behalf, put us here to do that. And indeed, that is what we will do in the new creation. We will rule with God in creation, rule with Christ. Ruling on behalf of God here in preparation for the future. Now, interestingly, if you look at Genesis 1:28, God blesses humanity in that as well. There's a blessing in doing that. It's not a chore. Now, another thing about the image of God, which would have been uppermost in the writer's mind when it was written, when Genesis was written, is that rulers used to set up images of themselves around the borders of their land. Here's one from 2000 years BC. And that image reminds you that the king is in control and that his rule rules in his land and that we should rule in the same way as he would. Now, the examples we have of Christ's rule over earth are not of a despot. They're actually one of a shepherd or a servant king. That's the role Jesus explicitly adopted when he came to earth. His rule was not for the benefit of himself, but for the benefit of others, for the benefit of the world we rule. And that's the way we should rule. So God cares that we should, God's commandment that we should. The third thing, again, which we've heard this morning, is that ruling properly, caring for the environment, is part of our love for our neighbours. So if you just take, for example, the issue of climate change, which I'll talk about most, the Bishop of London just recently captured headlines by proclaiming that making selfish choices such as flying on holiday or buying a large car are a symptom of sin. Now, a lot of people were very puzzled by that, particularly the secular press, and they couldn't quite make out what he was talking about. But you see, I think he was right, because unless we consider the impact of what we do, the decisions we make on others, whether they're our neighbour on the other side of the world, or our neighbour who has not yet been born, then that is a symptom of sin. That's the definition of sin, putting ourselves before others. I mean, ultimately, putting ourselves before God, saying, I want to rule on you, God. And it's interesting, isn't it, that those who suffer from rapid climate change won't be those of us in Britain, who will rather enjoy going to the Costa del Brighton, but it will be the poor, the marginalised, and those already living on the edge in places like Sub-Saharan Africa. They're the ones we've heard of the impact of increased droughts in some places, of increased susceptibility to floods, to disease, and heat waves in others. And the Christian is explicitly called to care for the stranger and the foreigner, even if, or perhaps especially if, they live somewhere where we can't see them. And that's a challenge for those of us in the high-income countries whose wealth has been created by profligate use of natural resources. Well, let me just say a few things about science, since this is Christian in science, and then we'll go to the third point about new creation. Three things. Species extinction, biodiversity, we've heard that. So I'll just make one point on this. I want to introduce you to Martha. Martha was a passenger pigeon, and Audubon was a great bird naturalist. In 1813, reported seeing a cloud of passenger pigeons flying over it. The cloud was so dense, he said, that the sky went dark, like as if the sun was in eclipse. He also said that secondly, he said the pigeon dropping fell like snow. And he estimated from how long this flag of birds took fire at him in 1813 that there were something like 25 billion passenger pigeons in that one flock. And yet you can see what people were doing in that picture. They were shooting them, actually just to provide food for their hogs or to fertilise the land. Well, Audubon painted beautiful bird pictures, as many of you will know. That's one of them, a passenger pigeon. And this is Martha. And Martha, I would say, was the last passenger pigeon ever, who died in captivity in Ohio in 1914. And she's now stuffed in the Natural History Museum in New York. That might be a modern parallel, frankly. The last one was shot in the wild by a 14-year-old boy a couple of years earlier in Ohio in 1900. So that's just something to remind us about the biodiversity, the biological side. Man, humankind, is the biggest age of extinction that has been for a very long time, for at least 60 million years. I'm a geologist, so let me just give you a geological example. Humans are now the biggest geological agent on Earth. They shift twice as much material as all of the geological processes in the world combined, all the landslides and rivers, Mississippi Delta, Ganges Delta, everything combined. In fact, if you put all the material that the humans have moved in the last 5,000 years, it would make a mountain 4,000 metres high, 40 kilometres wide, and 100 kilometres long. Big mountain. And by the end of this century, that mountain will have grown to be twice as long. We're a big agent in geology. But as I say, I want to just concentrate most on a few points about climate change, just reinforcing what John said earlier. Some people recently, I'm going to show you a couple of examples, went and found old pictures of glaciers, and then went back to the same place, further from as near as they could, the same location. That's a glacier in Argentina, taken in 1928 to 2004, the ice is gone. Now, glaciers actually take quite a long time to respond to here's an example from Europe. In Austria, 1875, if you stand on the exact same spot today, that is what you see. There's no doubt that climate change is occurring. Is humanity responsible for global warming? As that question skeptics ask often. Let me just show you one example from modelling, which was in the fourth IPCC report. This blue curve is the result of hundreds of models, climate models, the best there are, trying to reproduce the climate over the last 100 years, putting in all the known natural changes, volcanoes, El Nino, El Niña, etc. There's a ban because of the ban of many models. Now, on top of this, I'm going to put the actual observed temperature change, and you can see it starts to diverge at the end of the last century. It's quite markedly. The models do not fit. But now if you put in also the anthropogenic acids, carbon dioxide and so on, they fit rather well. This is a king curve. There's no doubt, really, it's very likely that humans are causing climate change. The fact of climate change, the IPCC used the term unequivocal. The first time they've ever used unequivocal for it. There is no doubt climate change is occurring. It's very, very likely it's due to humans. Now, somebody also asked about the geological time scale, the ice ages. So since I'm a geologist, I'm going to put in a picture of the last 160,000 years. That's the temperature change. And as John said, ice ages are formed by changes in the rotation between the sun and the earth. They were first explained by something called the Langfish. These changes were on 100,000 years ago. And there's about a 10 degree change between an ice age and an intervening ice age, such as we are now. Now I'm also going to put carbon dioxide through that period, and that reflects that pattern very accurately. Now it is true that the carbon dioxide lags the temperature change in this geological record by a few hundred years. And I take that not as a cause for complacency, but as a very scary observation. Because the fact is that if the temperature change goes up, then more carbon dioxide is released from the soil, from the sea, and that actually gives a positive feedback to the temperature. So that is a scary thought. It's not complacent. It's going to get worse. If humans cause warming, then that will be a positive feedback And just as John did, if I put on the temporary crumb bark by chain now, that is what it is doing. We are going way outside anything that has been experienced for at least 650,000 years. It's going to get a lot hotter than it ever has been in human water time. Here's the geological time scale, goes back to 80 million years now, just to show you that here, yes, it has been hotter in the past. It's been 6 to 7 degrees hotter in the past than it is now. We're in an ice age. If I put in, though, on the same time scale, what's happening now, it's that red line. And it's so steep, you can't see what's happening, can you? So I'm just going to blow up those last 100 years, or the next 100 years prediction, actually. That is what is thought to happen. Now, the fact that Earth has done it before is actually scary, because it means the Earth will do it again. There's no question the Earth can respond to changes like this. But the question is that the change is so rapid that humans cannot respond to it rapidly. Humans will be displaced. And humans depend on land. Humans fight wars over land boundaries. And that's what will happen. We can't just move somewhere else. Now, another thing that was alluded to this morning is global population. And this is also a significant factor. If we've got human population since Adam and Eve, the Olympic Mons in 10,000 BC, that is what is happening. It is rocketing us. And I'm not all that old, even though I've got grey hair, but the population of the world has almost tripled since I was born. And that is a major factor. And I think possibly the only way to respond to that is to improve education, to improve standard of living, because people have fewer children when they're better educated, have a better standard of living. And that is a very Christian imperative, isn't it? And missionaries have done for hundreds of years. And I think that's something we should take to heart. Well, we've seen stories about the inequity that those of us who cause the pollution benefit from it, those who suffer from it primarily are the ones who didn't cause it. There was a paper in Nature in 2000 estimating that something like 150,000 deaths per year were occurring then from the effects of climate change. Now, this is a hard number to get at, and I don't want to put too much weight on it, but it's in the right direction. Because if you're living in sub-Saharan Africa and you're malnourished and you're living on the edge, you will be more susceptible to disease or to loss of food from drought. Now, if I just put on top of that, you can see where the people who suffer are. They're in Africa, South America, Asia. So I put on top of that the changes in temperature that are expected at the end of this century. Look where they are seen, the same places. Sub-Saharan Africa, North Africa, Asia, South America. They're going to be impacted more than anybody else. They're the least able to cope. Well, somebody asked about other greenhouse gases. Methane accounts for about a quarter of the greenhouse warming due to anthropogenic gases. So let me just make one little side point, really, which is that actually cows produce 500 litres of methane per cow per day from both ends, not to put it too delicately. They are responsible for 18% of the global warming. There are 1.7 billion cows in the world. And that is an astonishing figure. It's more warming than all the transport put together, all the cars and trains and ships and boats and aeroplanes in the world. And by and large, it's driven by a thirst for meat. Apparently, when you get rich in India, the first thing you do is buy a jack and start to eat steak. And certainly, this is something that when I realised it, my wife and I now have we're not vegetarians, but we have a bias towards eating vegetarian food more often. Because it takes 10 kilos of vegetable protein to make 1 kilo of meat. We've heard this too, that floods are one of the world's main killers. I don't know if you know this, if you remember 13th of November 1970, but many families in Bangladesh do, because more than 500,000 people died on that day from flooding. You probably don't know these statistics because China's not been all that open in the last 50 years or so. But from floods to the Yellow River, up to 2 million people died in 1887, 1931, maybe nearly 4 million. And in the 20th century, it's been estimated that floods affected 100 million a year. And in this century, in fact, by 2025, half the world's population will be at risk from storms. Now, we had a lot of flooding in Britain recently, and 4 people died, and we were agonizing over it. But 50 million dying from it. Low-lying areas like the Maldives are going to be very vulnerable. And as we've heard, that will lead to refugees. And where will they go? We're not renowned for being very welcoming to refugees. So extreme weather events are a real issue about global warming, and they are what affect people, they are what cause death. So care for neighbour is a really important issue that we need to take real and concern about in our Christian response. Now, just the last bit of the talk then, I said I would talk about the Christian hope for the future, the new creation, which I think is significant and is something which we've neglected or else have taken to extremes. We know about what will happen from various passages, such as this one from Revelation 21, that the heaven and earth will pass away and God will come down to live with his people. There will be a new creation. Interestingly, usually read at funerals, but I was at a wedding last Friday, and they had this reading at their wedding reading, I think because it talks about the bride and the bridegroom. It is reality, but again, I want to stress, as I did before, the tension between the discontinuity that will be in the new creation and the continuity that will be. Christians often have to hold things in tension, and there are proofs of both ends. Now, for instance, somebody asked Paul what kind of body will we have when we're raised? What will it be like? You know what Paul's answer was? He said, that's a stupid question. Well, then he said, how foolish. And he went on to say that when you sow, you don't plant the body that will be, but just a seed, perhaps a wheat or something else. But God gives his body as he has determined. New creation will be in body. And to each kind of seed, he gives his own body. So wheat grows from seed. Or if you want to grow an oak tree, don't say plant a little baby oak, plant an acorn. So we will have bodies in new creation, but they're obviously not exactly like our bodies. They will be in body, but not exactly the same. The only person we know who's come back from the new creation was Jesus. He had a body, you could recognize it, you could touch it, you could feel it, but it could also walk through walls. Also, people didn't always recognize him initially. The disciples on the road to Emmaus didn't recognize him. Mary didn't recognize him. Acts 2, that Easter morning. She thought he was the God at first. So they're the same, but different. And interestingly, Jesus' body carried the scars of his life on earth. Remember, Thomas could feel the scar from the crucifixion. So there is some things from this world that will carry through to the next as they did there. And the Bible talks about that just a bit further on in Revelation 21. It says that the kings of the earth will bring their splendour into the new creation. The glory and honour of the nations will be brought into it. Now, they'll be refined as if by fire, says Peter. But in some sense, they're very. I'm really looking forward to there being great volcanoes in the new creation, great earthquakes. But the difference will be they won't kill anybody. They'll just be great to study. Our great theories will carry through, I presume. Now, let me just say a couple of things then, just to finish off about this new creation. Lord Rees, not speaking from a Christian viewpoint at all, but in his presidential address to the Royal Society, his president of the Royal Society said this just recently. He said, even in a cosmic or a geological time perspective, there's something unique about our century. Because for the first time in its history, our entire planet state depends on human actions and human choices. It seems to me that Christians are really well placed to do that. We have networks in every nation of the world, we have small communities in every nation of the world. Creation is a fundamental tenet of our beliefs. And if we're not taking the lead, then who will? And I am ashamed, really, that over the last few decades, we haven't taken the lead. We've left it, to be polite, a tree hugger. Some people who wear sandals or Luther is supposed to have said that if I knew Jesus would return tomorrow, I'd plant a tree today. And that seems to be a good attitude, that we should be preparing for heaven already. Because there is some sense in which it will be a recreation of this world. Well, I want to say two distinctive points in summary there. The first is that the distinctively Christian attitude is underpinned by hope. So it's worth working in creation now because not just because we're commanded to do so, which we are, but because it has a future, and what we do now doesn't matter for that future. You see, Jesus said he came to make all things new.
He didn't say he came to make all new things. So we should have faith, not that things can be different, but that things will be different. So we need to work in this world because Jesus gives meaning eternally to that world. And the second point is that the Christian view is holistic. We should have a view for the material as well as the spiritual reality of this world, because the new creation will embrace both aspects. So we should care for the creation in a way that shows our love and allegiance to God. And as C.S. Lewis said in this great quote I found, the Christians who did most for the present world were precisely those who thought most of the next. He said, aim at heaven and you get earth thrown in, aim at earth and you get neither. So Christians should care for the stranger and the foreigner. As I said, even in, or especially if we can't see them, if they live on the other side of the world, but are affected by our actions. And those of us who live in high-income industrialised nations, the standards of living that have been purchased through our profit at least of natural resources, we have a particular responsibility in our stewardship and an imperative to care for those elsewhere in the world who are marginalised by global climate change. Well, just one last thing I'd like to say. People have asked about some questions like, what about cosmic rays? What about various other factors? What about the fact that temperature seems to be carbon dioxide? There's a great book by the Royal Society just been put out, a little booklet, which answers some of those questions. I took their entire stock that's left, and it's on, they're free. You can get them off the bookstore. Or you can download it either off the Royal Society website or off the CIS website. And the other thing is that a friend and I have just written a book which amplifies some of this stuff much more than I've been able to here, called Christianity, Climate Change, and Sustainable Living. It's not actually published until the 23rd of August, but the publishers very generously allowed us to bring copies here. And you can even get it cheaper. Okay, thank you very much. Things in Britain, this I know you have no alternative to say really, but in Britain a lot of mothers get into their cars and drive 3/4 of the mile to school with their kids and drive back again. The great frustration and annoyance in the countryside. If they walk, they would actually enhance their relational wealth, if you like. They talk to other mothers at the school gate, they talk to their children on the way. I think it would be a lot better than driving. There's lots of things like that. Tearfund have some great stuff. They have a book that you can download or you can ask for off their website called For Tomorrow Too. Tearfund is a British evangelical relief fund. There's many other types. Practical things, but think it out for yourself.
Yeah, and I think also it's a question of not being complacent. You know, I think it was called Dylan's sense, swallow or cry, when it goes into my house. One I've always been fairly keen on. But we had a new look at that way of energy. And as a result of that, our materials and water have gone down by 10%.
It is often better for you. That's a point of this book, actually. There's a lot in this book about that. And actually, given the way God intended us to live in this world, we hear quite a big exegesis of Isaiah, which is all about how to live in this world in the way God made us to live, really. It's better off living the way He made us to live, actually.
Yeah. I have one more comment. I have one more comment in addition to your carbon dioxide warning. The slight acidification of our water resources, the ocean and so forth, and the future impact of these slight changes in changing all the productivity of that area.
Yeah,
Yep, there are a lot of very complex feedback, and it's a mistake to simplify the system, but we are at the time of that.
Okay,
any more? Yeah, or something? Yeah, there's being mics as well. The answer to the question, could I make a comment? Because there's a geneticist who works with livestock about the methane production around cattle. I like your comment about not being green, being like a rainbow. We need discernment in interpreting new information like this. The majority of the extra methane from cattle, of course, is coming from our cattle production in the West, where we're feeding very intensive, high production, high throughput grain, which is far more productive than methane, than 1 billion people in the world whose whole poor lifestyle is dependent upon their cattle. And we have to be careful that we don't denigrate them to their cattle while we are on the surface.
Indeed, in one of the active research projects in Aberystwyth, is looking at cattle diets in relation to intensive production and the output of methane.
So, if I may want to I once gave this talk at a Faraday talk, and there was a mother in there that came up to me afterwards and said, My daughter just started working with a very small charity that's had lots of, it's only 3 of them in it, called Send a Tag, who sent tags to rural communities, and a tag can be a lifeline, you know, provide milk and so on. So she said, should I stop it? I said, no, it's not great, that's great. you can say, probably have to take it there.
Oh. One more question, is there?
My question about globalisation. In my career, I've seen industries in the UK die. The reason being is because we have many environmental constraints, legal constraints, and we have many human employment and working conditions. And what has happened is that offshoring has taken place, we have sourced many of our products overseas, and although there is a face for all this, you know, we have an ethical program, the reality is that the world is full of manufacturing in developing countries that do not have the same standards of manufacturing that we have in the UK. They do not have the same care for the people that we would want to have. And so the whole globalisation issue is one that is full of problems to do with the environment and human beings. And somehow we need to bring that into our creation of care. Because people are part of this story, and you know, what ultimately matters is how we consume things. And so I would think, not just what we do with our homes, the way we use fuel, it's how we buy things. And I think that's an enormous area.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the book, we have at the back four sections today, local, community, national, and international. We look at those issues. I think we've been quite too faced really in exporting our solution and our problems abroad to get cheap stuff. And we had a speaker last week at Faraday who said they were astonished, they come from abroad, they're astonished when they went into shops in England, actually making quite cheap English. I'm not, you know, we tend to denigrate ourselves, but it is quite cheap. They said they were amazed at how much fair trade stuff was on sale, and that people will pay extra by fair trade, whether some fair trade food has got some guarantee of working conditions in the places that it's been manufactured. Now, there's lots of debate about it, as you can, you know, it's not perfect, but it's at least a step in the right direction. I absolutely agree with what you say. And actually, Christians again have a real opportunity to make an impact, because there are Christians all over the world. You can actually partner with people in other countries and get things at a higher level. I remember somebody from Sri Lanka coming of course, saying you could also always tell the overseas aid agencies, because they drove around in big white Land Rovers and stayed in hotels and kept in the best restaurants in the capital city, and then went for a drive in their big Land Rover out into the country. So it's much better to give money, and not a lot of money on them, small amounts of money, to people on the field, in the ground, local. And Christians have got such a great network. We've got a worldwide network to do that, so why don't we do it?
I absolutely agree with you. Thank you so much.